Drea, Samantha, and I are inching ever closer to our holiday episode of Ticklish Business talking about 1949's Holiday Affair. But in the meantime, I'm sharing with you some of my Patreon-exclusive content that I've been producing this year. Episode before, it was based on a true podcast, the show I do with William Bibbiani. And this episode, I'm actually sharing with you the other show I do, Doubled Features, with Adam Kautzer. In this episode, we talk about the dueling versions of The Blob, and things get a bit sticky. Welcome to Double Features, a Ticklish Business Patreon exclusive podcast where we look at movies so nice Hollywood made them twice, and sometimes more than that. I'm one of your hosts, Kristen Lopez, here with my co-host, Adam Kautzer. Adam, how are you?
I am fantastic.
We are both very excited to do this series for everybody. We both are big movie fans. We both watch a lot of these movies that end up getting remade. We figured, why not do a whole podcast about this, looking at how classic cinema sometimes doesn't work when it's translated to the modern era and vice versa. Adam, you are new to the Ticklish Biz fam, so why don't we give you a chance to share a little bit about yourself, what you write, where you are, all of that.
All right, absolutely. Well, first, thank you for allowing me to join the Ticklish Biz fam. I'm really excited about this. For the first 4 years that I, as a critic, I guess you could say I'm a blog boy. I used to write for a site called filmdispenser.com that has actually folded, and I've opened up my own website called The Movie Aisle, where we don't really necessarily talk a lot of pop culture films. We talk hard cinema, indie cinema. I have a podcast there, the B Movie Podcast, that does these double features where I pair forgotten or cult exploitation films together and discuss them on a weekly basis. My passion is, of course, writing. That's where my bread and butter is. I love writing about classic cinema or the in-between, as we're going to probably find out with my choices for the movies that we're covering here, that mine falls into this region of almost classic, but not quite. That's where I make my bread and butter. That's what I love in cinema. You guys are going to get to know me a little bit more as we move forward with this. Met Kristen at The Perfect Place, which is the TCM Film Festival that we've gone, what, 3 times now? I've known you for 3 of them now?
Or is yes. Yes, I believe so, yeah.
It's not a long time. It goes by so quickly that you don't realize that it's been like 3 years.
I would actually love TCM to do what we're doing and do a theme of the festival where they show certain classic movies with their modernized remakes. I think people would be very surprised by what has actually been remade.
Oh, yes. Just our schedule alone. There's one specific, I had to read it 3 times to really make sure that it was a remake. It was one of your choices. I was like, what? No.
And I think I know exactly what it is. It's the movie that I think I tell most people has actually been remade. They're like, really? And I think that's the good thing is our plans for the show develop. We want to look at the movies that have been remade maybe once. The movies that have been remade chronically. There's a movie that we're talking about later this year that has been remade several times, and we're going to look at all of those, and hopefully we'll have something good to say about some of them. But before we start, is there a movie that you feel that the remake has done better than the original? Is there a movie like that?
There are a couple. One of them is The Thing. John Carpenter's The Thing, 1982.
Oh, see, I actually like The Thing from Another World.
I like The Thing from Another World, but if we're talking pound for pound, ounce for ounce, like if we're talking about a fight, there's no contest for me. And it's really odd because it's the horror ones that are always the ones that stand out for me in remakes, because the other one for me is The Fly.
The remake of The Fly is infinitely better than the original.
Oh, yes.
And that's not to say that I don't like the original film. The Vincent Price one is very fun.
But it is definitely a Vincent Price movie of the
yes,
era.
Yes, it's very 1950s. The Fly is a better movie.
Yeah.
The one that I always go to bat for, and I think Adam's going to know exactly what it is, because he knows me, is Lolita.
Yes.
I think the 97 version of Lolita is better than the Kubrick version, and that might be blasphemous, because I know people that love the Kubrick version. I find the Kubrick version to be very silly. Now, mind you, I know there are very strict reasons for why the movie is the way it is. Yep. Neither version is the novel.
No.
But I do find the 97 version to be a better film, and I'm sure we'll get to that movie at some point, and I can prove to you all that I'm not a pervert, I swear. But yeah, that's the one I feel triumphs over the original. Let's get into the movie, because we got a lot to talk about. We tried to figure out a movie that we thought would be a good encapsulation of the show, the first episode, and that people would be interested to see how things played out. I didn't realize that we were actually perfectly timing this in more ways than one. This was Adam's choice. Adam picked The Blob. The 1958 version versus the 1988 version, and we're talking about it in 2018.
Which means that it's the 60th anniversary of The Blob, the original, and then the 30th anniversary of the 88, which begs to ask, why didn't they get their crap together to do a 2018 Blob?
Because they realized that the last time they remade The Blob, I had just been born. And they didn't want to make me feel bad about my birthday this year. That's what I'm guessing. I'm spitballing. We can talk about, yeah, why the movie hasn't been remade since the 30 years since the last one. The plots are similar.
Yes.
Alien life form comes to Earth, consumes everything that it touches, and a group of scrappy teens have to find a way to stop it by first getting people to believe that the thing exists and also to find a way to stop it.
Dave, Doc Hallen's been killed.
Doc Hallen, what happened?
It's over at his place. You gotta come now.
Oh, wait a minute, Steve. Tell us what happened.
Well, I'm trying to tell you. Now, this thing had killed the Doc.
But what was it? Stop with it, kid.
Well, it's kind of like a... It's kind of like a mass that keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Every one of you watching this screen, look out. Because soon, very soon, the most horrifying monster menace ever conceived will be oozing into this theater. Two teenagers see it first, like a falling star from outer space.
Boy, that was close. Hey, come on, I want to see if I can find it.
An old man finds it, touches it, and this is the shocking result. From then on, there's no stopping the blob as it spreads from town to town.
I had seen the original. I had seen the Steve McQueen version. I had not seen the 88 version. Most people that I asked about this remake had said that it wasn't good, so I just never really watched at all. I rewatched both of them relatively close together, and I realized that the 58 one, the camp quality aside, is actually really boring.
Yeah.
It's an hour and 26 minutes, and not a whole lot happens. What was your background with the 58 one? Had you seen it before? What did you think of it?
Okay, so yeah, I had seen it. My dad loved 50 sci-fi. So like when I was a kid, it was Robinson Crusoe on Mars, Forbidden Planet, The Blob. Anything that he saw as a kid was something that I was going to be watching. Over the years, it's come to light to me. When I was a little kid, it was great. I loved it. The same guy that was in The Magnificent Seven played a teenager in a movie about a jello killing people. That was my shtick. Well, that was fertile ground for a little Adam. But as I've grown up and I've watched this multiple times, I mean, I own it. There's a Criterion disc, beautiful Criterion disc. I realized about the last, not this past viewing, but two viewings before, that this is really bad. And I think a lot of it has to do with Irvin S. Yeasworth Jr. as the director, who had not directed anything other than educational videos. It's like Herschel Gordon Lewis. It's pretty painful to watch this at times.
Yeah, it plays like there were attempts, I believe, after this to turn it into a television show. Because everything at that point in the late 50s was grist for TV.
Yeah.
And this movie plays like a pilot. There's actually moments in the film where they play musical cues like the lead into a commercial break.
Yep.
It leads to a very TV movie quality. This was one of six films, technically five, the last one is a short, that Irvin S. Yeaward Jr. made. It had been 2 years since his debut, which was the film The Flaming Teenage, which sounds about as entertaining as it looks. It's 69 minutes about a small town boy who heads for the lights of the big city and discovers the delights of hard liquor and fast women. He becomes an addict, a dope peddler, and a shoplifter to obtain booze. Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. He also made a film called The 4D Man and Dinosaurus.
I've seen 4D Man. It does not live up to its title. I have to ask, it's really interesting to like watch this film and realize, going back to that time frame, do you think that people actually, it delivered for them?
I'd like to think that it did. I mean, this was built for the drive-in. This was a movie that was tailor-made for horny teens to go to the drive-in and make out and get a little scared. You had mentioned that this was a double bill here with I Married a Monster from Outer Space. If you've seen I Married a Monster from Outer Space, which I have, it's about on par with The Blob in terms of quality. So I definitely think that there's validity to it was the hit when it came out.
No, absolutely. I was actually looking at it, and it cost $50,000 to make, and it made $4 million. That is a 4,000% return on profit. So what I always find funny is that as much as the business changes and evolves, there's certain things that will always stay steady and true, is that if you make a halfway decent horror film and you market it perfectly, you will get some business out of it.
It made money, and Steve McQueen was actually mad after the fact. He was offered points on the back end if the movie had made a profit. Mm-hmm. And he decided to just take the, I think it was $2,500 that they offered him for the film, and said this movie wasn't going to be a hit. And then the movie was, and he was really, really mad for the rest of his life. At that point, he always took points instead of a huge amount of money, because he knew there was more money to be made after the movie was released in residuals than anything else. This had to work for people of the 1950s. I don't believe that it worked when they did the sequel, Beware the Blob, in 1972. That's neither here nor there.
No, absolutely. I honestly wonder if, because we both have seen it, a hit song translates into at least opening box office. I almost wonder if the Burt Bacharach co-written song is what pushed it over the top.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door, all around the wall, a splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
I know a lot of people that don't remember this movie, but they remember the song. And I can tell you, since I watched this 3 days ago, I've been singing the damn song. The song is like one line. There's no lyrics. It is the same line repeated over and over. I described it as, if anybody's seen Inside Llewyn Davis, the joke song that they record.
Yes. Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Yes, it is that song. That's exactly what it is. And I was sitting there thinking, oh, God. That would have been a Coen Brothers movie to make right there, about them making the Blob song. Well, we should introduce the 88 remake so that we can start going back and forth. They remade this in 1988, 30 years after the original come out.
Directed by a genre stalwart, Chuck Russell, written by Frank Darabont, who, after coming off of the horror hit Nightmare on Elm Street 3, got a chance to do this, put their spin on the 58 original.
If it had a mind, you could reason with it. If it had a face, you could look it in the eye. If it had a body, you could shoot it. Now, man is no longer the supreme being on this planet.
The organism is growing at a geometric rate. By all accounts, it's at least 1,000 times its original mass.
Nobody believes me about what happened tonight.
What did happen?
The Blob. terror has no shape.
I find it weird that people have said that this movie is a bad movie. It's not necessarily a bad movie. It's got some really great moments, but ultimately there's certain things that hobble it. Direction-wise and writing-wise, it's definitely an uptick.
I'm going to second what you're saying. This is a better made movie. It helps that it has a budget. I think it reads the room better than the 58 version did.
Yes.
The plot is the exact same concept in theory. Have this mystery object that lands in the fictional town of Arborville, California. A group of teens have to get the blob to stop consuming things. As soon as I saw Jeffrey DeMunn in this movie, I thought, this isn't a Darabont thing, right? No? And then I realized it was. I was like, because of course it is. The Darabont thing really explains a lot about this movie. Probably explains why I liked it so much. Because I tend to be a fan of what Darabont sells me. This is a movie that was a box office flop.
Yes.
It had a budget of $19 million, only made $8.2 in the middle of 1988. I think that's a shame. But at the same time, it's really coming at a very weird time. 58, the movie is hoping to capture the juvenile delinquent, which was already slowly changing into the flower child hippie concept that would come to define the 60s. But at the same time, teens, they still had limited availability in terms of what was out there. So they would see anything because the drive-in, again, was a place where what you were watching on screen didn't really matter. By 88, though, horror specifically, as you and I both know, is very different. You're getting a lot of the discussion of not only what was appropriate for teens to see with the whole video nasty thing that was happening in England. You had the AIDS crisis, which we're going to talk about. This movie is essentially an allegory for.
Yeah.
You also had the end of the slasher genre. And this is not a slasher film. This is a monster movie, which by the late 80s was not in vogue. Unless you had a hockey mask or you were Robert Englund, I wasn't even born. August 5th? I wasn't born until September 1st, so I was still percolating. But I don't remember a lot of big monster movies from the 80s.
There's not. The ones that did come out were like The Blob. They were massive failures. If you're talking the big guns, macro as in size, Godzilla 1985 should have been at least some kind of hit. Some kind of hit. It's the abysmal of box office receipts for the entire Godzilla series. It just gives you an idea. For whatever reason, in the 80s, we wanted very cardboard cutout, stereotypical villains. We wanted Jason. We wanted Freddy. We wanted those guys that we knew we could defeat. Something amorphous like The Blob is something that gets under your skin. It was a little bit too soon, maybe, because the AIDS epidemic was becoming an epidemic, or at least the media was starting to portray it as it should have been, which is a major health crisis. This film, what I love about it, tagging on to that whole AIDS epidemic or just viruses in general, is that it's indiscriminate. There are some deaths in this film, in the 88 version, that you just go, oh, what?
To jump back a sec, the fact that horror was really delineated into horror, which was for teens, and then there was the possession films, the adult dramas,
yes,
that were really horror movies, but they were classy. They were The Omen. It was not a horror movie, even though it is a horror movie, but it had big actors. And even by the late 80s, you weren't really getting that, but that was what this movie was hoping. It would be that bridge between the two, and it just wasn't. By 88, AIDS was something that we all knew about. Was it this year that Reagan actually said AIDS at that point? It was either 87 or 88. This is also a movie that deals with the death of a small town, the rise of corporate interests. This was more gruesome because, again, you're trying to get the teens. You bring up that some good people die in this movie, sometimes off screen. There is a character that they introduce that you think is going to have a big presence in this film. I mean, we can throw spoilers out there because this movie's over 30 years old. The sheriff him and the little diner waitress, they have this little meet cute, and he's gonna get involved with her, and he literally dies off camera. The only way you know he dies is you see his face in the blob for a split second, so if you're looking down to get popcorn, you're just gonna assume he never came back. I love the subversion of trope. It doesn't happen often in this movie, but the movie introduces the football player, Paul, played by Donovan Leach Jr. He's this nice guy. The McQueen character gets split into three in this movie.
Yes, he does. And that was an interesting choice to me, because in the 58 version, it's him and then these guys that you think are going to be a threat. And then with some really weird and awkward dialogue, they become buddies.
The McQueen character, A, is the oldest high schooler. He's up there with the Grease kids. He was 27 when he made this movie, and he looks 35. This is one of those movies where it feels like they're trying to capture the zeitgeist, how the kids talk. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't sound comfortable spouting any of the dialogue. His relationship with the girl, Jane, played by Anita Coursant, who was best known Andy Griffith. She had essentially been hired, I think, like the day before to replace somebody. She has no chemistry with McQueen's character. He just seems like a creeper leching on a young girl. Again, he looks really old in this movie. Steve McQueen never looked young. But there's also really no definition to his character. His name is Steve Andrews. He has no personality. And I love that the movie sets up that he's driving recklessly, and he drives backwards, and oh no, he's a bad kid. And then the cops just don't believe him for the rest of the whole movie, and I'm just sitting there thinking, really? Look at him, he's wearing a sweater. He's not a bad guy. In the 88 version, there's three distinct characters. So you have the Paul character, who dies within the first 20 minutes of the movie in a very grim way, and I was genuinely shocked when that happened, because I'm thinking, oh my god, he was our hero. All bets are off at that point, and I really liked that. Then the movie becomes splitting the Steve character into Meg, played by Shawnee Smith, mm-hmm. who is the take charge final girl, because again, you're in 88, so everybody had a girl.
Yep.
And then the Kevin Dillon character, Brian, who is literally the leather jacketed, motorcycle riding, mullet wearing leader of the pack. The only thing that's missing is he's not smoking like Marlboros and swilling a bottle of Jack. He's a bad guy, but he's not a bad guy that's going to corrode his liver and his lungs. That gives them personality. I root for them more than I rooted for Steve and Jane.
That's definitely the case. What I find interesting is they change certain things within the film, within the 88 film, as opposed to the 58 film, to allow for a little bit more conflict internally, so that it's not just the blob. There's little moments in this film, and I think it's the Darabont touch. I'm pretty sure it is. Just the way that certain things play out, like the Jeffrey DeMund and Candy Clark characters, and how their storyline goes. And you know that it's a setup. But what I love about the setup and the payoff is the payoff. A little secret about me is that I like it when monster movies, not necessarily serial killer movies, but monster movies are really evil and they're mean. I don't want my serial killer movies to be like that so much per se, but I definitely like my monster movies like that. And this movie is mean about what it does to its characters. That moment with Candy Clark in the telephone booth is just mean. But it's mean in the best way possible, because it gets you like a visceral gut reaction after you've come to care about these two people, even though it's telegraphed a mile away that you pretty much are sure that as soon as these two show up, they're going to be fodder for the blob.
You brought up the term indiscriminate. That goes back to the whole AIDS epidemic. It's this concept that good people get hit by terrible, terrible things. We don't know if these people are good or bad, but they've been presented as normal people. This is a very white movie. Dr. Meadows,
yes,
played by Joe Seneca, is the lone person of color in this film, and he is the bad guy.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure how I feel about that, and we can come back to that in a second, but I do feel that this movie, as we were slowly getting the AIDS crisis out there and saying it wasn't just gay men that it was affecting, the movie does have It's very 80s, so it's not good or bad. It's pretty much saying, small town white America, this could happen to you. This is what can happen if we don't stop this now or we don't acknowledge it. I do want to bring up, Chad McQueen was offered the role of Brian Flagg, the Kevin Dillon character, as an homage to the original film, and he refused it because he didn't want to play in a role that his dad had played. And I actually think that's to his benefit. Kevin Dillon is fine. Yeah. He's always going to be the other Dillon.
Yes, he is.
And I do think, really, this is the showcase for Shawnee Smith.
Oh, it definitely
is. Really, really liked her. I liked that we made the main character a girl. We throw out a lot of final girl tropes, too, because I think most people identify the final girl as she's the virgin,
yeah,
who doesn't really do anything bad, and the movie doesn't even bring any of that into play. That's not even mentioned. There's not a scene where she has to fight a guy off or anything. She's just a person who happens to be a girl. There is a moment, though, with the lovers on Lover's Lane. The girl was played by Erica Oleniak. I was very surprised to see her. It could have gotten a little date rapey.
Yes.
It does get a little date rapey. They're both quickly dispatched in a way that I was like, well, did we have to get a little handsy before she died? I would have liked the scumbag to get killed off beforehand. But Shawnee Smith's really good. She's active. There are moments where she is saved by Brian, but she's always either leading the charge or working in conjunction with him.
Another thing that I liked that they bucked the convention on was the cheerleader trope. She's not a cheerleader that going around like what they typically do in 80s movies. She's a good kid. She's a good daughter. And most of all is that she's a good sister to her brother.
That's the big distinction between her and Jane in the 58 version.
Yes.
Jane is so thirsty for Steve McQueen in this movie for reasons that she finds a dog. The old man that is killed first in the 58 version has a dog.
Yeah.
She becomes very attached to this dog, which, if you know Hollywood coding, is the child surrogate. She has no personality. She doesn't care what is happening, but the dog. The dog needs to be okay. And here, there is no dog. Meg and Brad have this chemistry, but there's no emphasis on a relationship. They don't stop what they're doing to make out and declare their love for each other. The movie ends with really no indication that they're going to stay together past the end of this movie. And I really like that because I hate how they force relationships in horror films because, as Sandra Bullock taught us in Speed,
yes,
any relationship built on a life or death situation is doomed to fail.
It is a very refreshing story arc that she's not any of those things. It's not to say that in the 80s that this wasn't prevalent. It was still very prevalent. Everything that happened in the 58 version, in any other horror film, it's pretty typical that all of these indicators are things that happen in typical slasher films, which Shawnee Smith, I love her. I loved her since I saw her in Summer School, which is one of my favorite comedies from the 80s. I love that movie for very specific reasons, but she's great in that movie. And she's basically one of those actresses that I feel like she didn't really get her shot at other things other than horror and genre. If you follow her career, you know she goes on to star and be a major part of the Saw franchise.
That's where I had seen her. When I saw her in this, I was like, oh, she's Amanda from the Saw movies. So it was really, really refreshing to see her in this movie where she's not an idiot. She's not a victim, nor is she really the final girl as Carol Clover has backpedaled and changed over the years. She really is the purest encapsulation of a lead performance that just happens to be feminine. And I think that really, really works to this movie's benefit, especially because she's the one that ends up killing it at the end. Brian is the one that's trapped in the tanker with the hydrogen, and she's the one that saves him at the end of the movie.
Which, I have to ask, how awesome but totally 80s is that image of her shooting the M16 from the hip to save Brian?
I was thinking, if this movie had made more money, and I know it has quite the cult following, if it had made more money, it would have been the stay away from her bitch scene of the late 80s. The 58 version, the blob is pretty broad. Yes. It could be anything. It stands for anything bad or all-consuming. In the 50s, we all know there was a lot of things to fear. It's red, so you could literally say it's the Red Scare. Or conformity, the threat of science, things from another world. This concept that there was more happening beyond American borders that we didn't know. You also had issues with Red China. I mean, so there's this concept that it really stands for anything that is not American. But specifically, communism. At one point, Steve says, how do you get people to protect themselves from something they don't believe in? As much as I love that the 58 version is all about teens banding together, this concept of the youth of America is going to be what helps propel us into the future. It's actually a very timely message, considering our current politics and youth. It is a bit silly because the blob is not particularly intimidating. It's still this bland mix of red dye and silicone. Doesn't move very much. The only real power we know that it has is that it consumes everything. But we don't really know how or what or why. And we know that it can't be killed by anything. The doctor tries to use acid that is essentially used for genital warts, and it doesn't kill it. And then he says, when the acid doesn't work, he's like, bring me my gun. Because if we can't scorch it, we can shoot it. There's really not a lot of rules created with the 58 version. This is a thing that is evil, and yet we don't really know what to do with it. So the end really feels like a deus machina, where the movie's got to end. This is what we're doing.
I would say that there is one specific rule, which is the cold. But we're not told that until the very last minute. So it becomes a deus machina, which I find ironic because it does feel like a Cold War film. Not like a Red Scare Cold War film, but not in the razor sharp fashion that Invasion of the Body Snatchers is. Nothing near that. But then again, I mean, you got Don Siegel working on that film. Here you don't have Don Siegel. But here it's interesting because you are right. It is amorphous. It's like it could stand for multiple things inside of the film. But I lean into the Cold War Red Scare thing. I feel like it was a cash in, cash grab after seeing the success of Invasion of the Body Snatchers that they could glom that on. Because if you really think about it, Invasion of the Body Snatchers was something that was also amorphous that you couldn't do anything about, though there are very strict rules and they adhere to those rules, unlike in The Blob. It grows, it eats things, and it just continues to evolve and grow. And maybe that's the kind of thing that they wanted to do, was just sledgehammer scare. The Russians are coming, the Russians are coming, this big red blob is going to take over.
The whole thing ends very silly. They call the Air Force to transport the blob to the Arctic.
Yes, which in a fit of very timely, very timely one-liners, what does he say at the end?
The blob isn't dead. It's been stopped for now. And Steve says, yeah, as long as the Arctic stays cold. And I'm like, well, Steve, the blob is definitely coming back for us now. What a lot of people remember about the blob, the scene in the movie theater.
Yes.
Which is retained in the remake to bigger and better and grosser effect. But it does lead you to this whole question too. The blob could also stand in for the mindless entertainment. You brought up that the director worked with educational films.
Yes.
You see these teens being consumed in a movie theater by this amorphous, faceless blob, not unlike what was commonly referred to in 1958 as the boob tube.
Yep.
Teens were getting consumed by television, was seeing them as consumers to be sold stuff. So again, it's got that on the nose reminder that parents, this is what your children are watching. In the 88 version, all of that is effectively thrown out the window, because in 58, where there was kind of a message, by 88, there was so much message, we didn't really know what to do with it. So this one is based on the AIDS crisis, of course. There's a lot of comparisons to other movies that I saw, something like Red Dawn.
Yes.
Which had come out in 84. This idea of something coming from communist countries and being used against us.
What's going on here, my friend?
Georgia,
Alex, I'm in trouble.
This is the emergency broadcast system. We are under attack by conventional forces of the Russian army. It is believed the lead waves were disguised as commercial charter flights. Communications have broken down with other parts of the country. Large areas of the Midwest may have been overrun.
You're 40 miles behind the enemy line.
They're gonna kill us!
All of us!
So why should we be different?
Because we live here!
The movie pretty much says this is a man-made meteor used to spark a war with Russia. Essentially germ warfare created by scientists. You still see this now, to bring it all back to AIDS, this idea that AIDS was created in a lab by scientists and just released into the populace. The whole comparison to germ warfare, AIDS, all goes back to Russia. Red Dawn plays right into that. I also saw, this came out after, I saw comparisons to The Stuff.
Warning. We interrupt this presentation with the following urgent message regarding The Stuff. If you see it in stores, call the police. If you have it in your home, don't touch it. Get out. The Stuff is a product of nature, a deadly living organism. It is addictive and destructive. It can overcome your mind and take over your body. And nothing can stop it.
Are you prepared to say on the air that you've actually seen people devoured by The Stuff?
Tonight, America is in grave danger.
The Stuff. You have been warned.
About sentient food stuff. It's like Soylent Green meets The Blob. It's very funny.
That was actually before The Blob. It was, I think it was like 85, 86. I'm a huge Larry Cohen fan. You're absolutely right. The Stuff is about consumerism, just blindly following consumerism. And it does definitely tread on very similar ground as the 88 Blob does. It is interesting that there's a lot of message going on here under the surface and then also above the surface. The Blob 88 is not satisfied with just being undercover like most great horror films with its message. It has to do both. It has to scream it at the top of its lungs, but also send you those subliminal messages. It makes for an interesting watch, to say the least, with 30 years removed.
There's a lot of really intriguing symbolism, where the original was about teens having to band together as a take back of the juvenile delinquency film that it ruined their name. This is about the town having to band together against science, against the government. I guess this brings us back to the Dr. Meadows character played by Joe Seneca, and the only person of color in this entire film, and he is the villain. And I'm really not sure how I feel about that.
You have every reason to do that, because what I think started off as innocuous and non-thought, the unfortunate part is that I think if you release this today, it becomes something entirely different. The message that you're talking about becomes very clear to certain people. It makes it all the more weirder to me is that the ending, evangelical.
The ending is so bizarre to this movie. There is a revisionist, maybe, take back to it, which is that this movie, which is about an AIDS allegory, there's this whole concept of AIDS truthers that believe that it was created in a lab to kill people of color and gay people. It is a bit ironic to twist it around and have the man of color being the villain who is in this position of power. But at the same time, he really sticks out because the movie is so white. And I doubt that anybody in 88 was actively looking at this and seeing it that way. But it is very telling that he is the person of color in this movie who is totally content with letting two teenagers die in a sewer in the hopes of preventing this from spreading. Why they don't think that it will spread beyond the sewer system is beyond me, but that's their plan, at least. I do want to bring up before we get to the end that this blob, the biggest change I think between both movies is that this blob is not just way better movement-wise and looks-wise. It's corrosive.
Yes, it's acid, basically.
It's basically melting everything, which means all bets are off in terms of how to deal with it. But it does have a defined weakness, which is cold. I'm a big sucker for practical effects.
Yes.
We don't see them anymore. Some of the blob deaths in this movie are really, really gross and really cool. In the vein of stuff like, I love, if anybody's seen Poltergeist 2, Craig T. Nelson barfs up
the tequila worm.
That's one of my favorite special effects. When Paul is killed while making a phone call in the doctor's office and it just falls on him, that is probably the best scene in the movie.
When Meg is grabbing his arm, trying to pull him out, just melts basically his arm off and she drops it. And then it's the melting of his face that just, you just go, ooh.
And that was all practical. Yep. That was all practical effect. That's an actual person under there. And that makes it even more frightening because you know that that's something that involves a human. Even the death of Candy Clark, the waitress, which I wondered if that was an homage to the birds.
I thought the same thing because what she's wearing.
And the phone booth and the all-consuming nature and the glass cracking. I was like, it's the birds, right?
Yep.
Which would not surprise me because Darabont is an old movie fan. That's the thing that I really like. We have hard rules for this thing. And so when they get the hydrogen truck, which I paid attention, I still don't know how that happened.
Isn't there two African-American characters in this? If I'm not mistaken, the mechanic is two.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And he has that liquid nitrogen machine in his garage, and I'm wondering if it's some snowmaker. It is a snow.
Yeah, that's
town.
Right.
And they were talking about how they didn't have a snow last year, and that really hurt them. Could very well be that that's the case. And
they crystallize the blob and blow it up, and it turns into frozen little pink cubes, which made me think that so if they ever make a sequel of the stuff or Soylent Green, they're definitely eating that, right?
Yeah.
You brought up the ending, because it's the 1980s. It has a creepy priest in it, a reverend, but a creepy man of the cloth. Reverend Meeker, played by Del Close, who is the creepiest guy. It has to be intentional. Sidling up on the young guy, and he's like, hey there, what are you buying at the store? There's small town, and then there's weirdo. But he is attacked by the blob and lives, and becomes Jim Jones.
Yes.
As soon as I saw the look that he's wearing all black, he's got the sunglasses, he's got the hair, and most of his congregation is older African-Americans. I was like, he's Jim Jones.
Yep.
But it's like, no, he's Jim Jones. The movie ends with a sequel blob in there. I was very confused. I know that they have to telegraph a sequel, but why Jim Jones?
The only thing I can think of is they're a little bits of Stephen King-isms in this film, if you really...
That makes sense, too.
So, watching it this time, as soon as that character came on, I was like, oh, that guy's a Stephen King character. He's a straight-up out of Derry, Maine, or Castle Rock, Maine. And then there's just little things. Brian's last name is Flagg, and he wears a leather jacket. He looks a lot like Randall Flagg, who ends up being the main villain in The Stand. It's the classic Stephen King setup of It or Needful Things. Any number of his films about these small towns didn't feel like so much like it was something that dictated as much as it was something that Frank Darabont was trying to get away with. Maybe more complicit with Chuck Russell in that. And they were like, ooh, you know what would be great? Is we could have like this Jim Jones scene at the end. If we have a sequel, we can make it all about the religion now.
I was really happy to see Jack Nance in this movie.
Yes.
He plays the doctor.
Yes.
You might know him as the lead from Eraserhead.
Also in Twin Peaks.
That's true. To throw some more David Lynch at you. I am not as big a David Lynch fan as I am a Frank Darabont fan. Both of these movies had sequels. The 58 version had a sequel made in 1972 called Beware the Blob, which was directed by Larry Hagman, of all people. They actually sold this movie as the movie that JR shot.
The Blob is back in a horrifying new adventure. And you are there. startled, stunned, terrified, as the blood-red creature rolls over and eats everything in its path.
We're going to burn the place down. I can't take any chances.
Beware the Blob. Beware Godfrey Cambridge. Beware Carol Lindley. Beware Shelley Berman. Beware the Blob. Larry Hagman and his pals tried to stop the Blob with a pitchfork. Beware the Blob.
So Beware the Blob took place 15 years after the events of the first movie, and it involved a oil pipeline lawyer going back to his L.A. home from the North Pole, bringing home with him a sample of a mysterious frozen substance that they found on a job site. So it's essentially the thing from Another World in L.A.
Yes.
So it sounds like. It's got Burgess Meredith, Del Close is in this as well.
Yep.
Dick Van Patten, Cindy Williams. It's got names, which is worth it, but this, I believe, was not a big success. There's a review by Kim Holston and Tom Winchester who consider this film, quote, it's viewed as a relic of mid to late hippiedom, and that it's really not that good. I don't even have box office available for it.
I talked to my dad. I was watching The Blob, and we talked about the sequel, and he swears up and down that I've seen it. He showed it to me. Watching trailers for it, I've not nary a clue. You want a different director and writer to take this concept and work with it, because there's something there, it looks like, from the trailer. From everything you read about it, it just looks like the execution was terrible. Terrible. I could not find it. I did want to watch it just because of the fact that I'm a completist like that, and I'd like to be able to talk about something with a little bit more authority, but could not find it for the life of me, even though they've said that there are DVDs out of it. I've just not seen.
And Beware of the Blob also moonlights under the name Son of the Blob. The 88 one did not have a sequel.
No, it did not.
So before we decide what's the better version, if you only have to watch one, what's the better version? Let's give our thoughts overall on both movies. I really enjoy the 58 version as a piece of novelty. It's a very slow 90 minutes, but it's a novelty piece. You're getting what you pay for. You want to see Steve McQueen in his film debut. You want to see the movie that was a staple of the drive-in culture. If you have to watch a movie that really sums up the 50s, or at least what adults thought the 50s were and what teens wanted, then you need to watch The Blob. The 88 version, I think, is a more cynical film. It's darker. It's unrepentant. It's a really, really fun entry into the monster film that was not a thing in the late 80s. This feels like it wandered in from the mid-70s or mid-90s, when monster films were starting to come back into vogue. I think it's got some fun lines. I love Shawnee Smith. And Kevin Dillon's hair is worth the price of admission. Just look at it. Oh, my God. Shawnee Smith's a beautiful girl, but her hair is pretty terrible in this movie, too. But Kevin Dillon's hair, it's just, it needs to be seen. I really like both. Mm-hmm. And overall, the 88 version is better. Adam,
with regards to the 1958 version of The Blob, it's one of those films that has gained a classic status that has aged very badly over the years. I can see within its DNA and its bone structure something that many people, a la somebody like, say, Joe Dante, would take and would keep close to them. It's like everything from the 50s, but not like anything from the 50s. I do gravitate towards how technicolor poppy it is in the colors within the film, but it doesn't equal a great movie. It's a film that's a relic of its era. I'm a completist when it comes to Steve McQueen. I love Steve McQueen. Seeing this is one of those things where I would definitely suggest, if you do like McQueen, to see where he started, because it's not very good, but you can only go up from there. And I mean, if you think about it, 2 years later, he's in one of the best westerns of all time, the ripoff of Seven Samurai, The Magnificent Seven. But then we have its remake 30 years later, which is a tight, compact, mean piece of work. You look at it, and at first glance, you don't think that it's going to be anything other than a remake of The Blob. But within it, it's just this mean, nasty little monster horror film that takes no prisoners and is just an awesome piece of 80s pop confection. Now, both have messages, but as we've talked about, both messages are muddled for different reasons. Ultimately, like you, Kristen, I side on the 88 version because if we're going to use a music analogy, The Blob is a Burt Bacharach song, and The Blob 88 is a Def Leppard song. I'll always go with the Def Leppard song.
That is the best analogy ever to compare two movies about gooey red ball-like structures.
And something that you didn't mention, you have to see this movie to add on to what you were talking about with Shawnee Smith and Kevin Dillon. You have to watch it for their hair because they essentially have the same haircut.
They like, really do. One's just a girl version.
Yeah, but she is rocking the crap out of that lady mullet. Something that we didn't talk about that I love about the 88 version, the clothes. Oh, when she says, when she excitedly hears that her mom is going to let her use her cashmere sweater and she goes out like she's Nancy Reagan circa 1987. Ooh, Lord, that was some good stuff.
The 80s were real time if you were a girl, too. So many movies were centered around an item of clothing that they really thought looked good. And in 20 years, that outfit is going to be the bane of your existence. I'm putting that cashmere sweater next to the suede suit that What's-Her-Face wore in Can't Buy Me Love.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Girl, it probably looked really great in the 80s, but 98 rolls around and you're like, nope, hard pass. Well, listeners, you can tell us whether we are totally wrong and the 58 version of The Blob is better. You can send us your thoughts on either version of the film, suggest movies that we should do in the future, give us suggestions on how we can make this show better, because this is the first episode, so Test and Adjust will be going on in subsequent episodes. We accept all feedback. You can send that to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com. Also, be sure to follow Ticklish Business on Twitter at ticklishbizpod. You can also find me on Twitter at journeys_film. And you can listen to the show. This is Patreon exclusive for the foreseeable future, and we thank you for your patronage. But you can also listen to my regular show, Ticklish Business, which is available on ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, as well as Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Player FM, all those places that you find podcasts. If you want to listen to our other work, you can listen to me on the feminist film podcast, Citizen Dame, which is citizendame.podbean.com. Adam, where are you on the internet? Where can people see your writing, contact you on social media, all of that?
You can follow me at The Movie Aisle. That's where all my writing is. You can follow me on Twitter at Tyrufus_McCoy. It is a very weird name. I maybe explain it sometime soon in the near future, but it is spelled TYRUFUS_MCCOY. You can also follow my podcast that I run, the B Movie Podcast, and that is on Twitter, B Movie Pod. The letter B, the word movie, the word pod, all together, no lines, no dashes, no mishigosh.
Well, thank you for listening to the first episode of Double Features. We're going to be doing this every other month as we switch things out between this and my other new spinoff show, which is based on a true podcast, co-host William Bibiani. So hopefully you will enjoy both podcasts enough that you'll listen to both. And Adam and I will be back next time talking about another two movies, maybe more than two movies, who knows, that Hollywood seemed to think were worth doing again. Till next time, everybody.